It didn't take long for me to become scared of silence after moving to New York. What I used to find so calming, so comforting, growing up in a small town in a small house, set far back from the road in a small patch of woods, now makes every last hair on my body stand upright as I wait for it to be broken with something I don't want to hear. I went on a weekend trip upstate with a man I spent 3 reckless months with 2 years ago, and as I lay next to him in the pitch blackness, waiting to fall asleep, I made the mistake of realizing that I noticed no difference between my eyes being open and my eyes being shut. It was so dark and so, so quiet that I quickly managed to convince myself I was in nothingness. I couldn't hear anything. I couldn't see anything. Surely, I thought, I must be dead. I reached out wildly for him, gripped his arm hard to make sure he was there, make sure he was real. He jolted awake, thrashing towards me, hitting me in the face. He did that sleepy pulling me into his chest thing that boys do when they are briefly awakened, and within seconds resumed his deep, raspy breathing, verging on snores. Normally, this irritated me, and I'd prod him in different directions until he settled into a position that allowed him to breathe properly. But that night, the noise seemed gentle, welcomed. My eyes danced around the room looking for shadows that proved I could still see. No, now I much prefer the ever-present rumble of cars that, when you push it far enough to the recesses of your consciousness, sounds like waves. The sirens, the lilting patois, the thud of bass, even the shouted ramblings of drunks provide some kind of buffer between my thoughts and that nothingness. I hear people talk wistfully of living in a cabin miles away from your nearest neighbors in the middle of nowhere. Ultimate privacy. Ultimate peace and quiet. That sounds like a nightmare. No, I always want to be reminded that I am not alone. Of course, there is that classic paradox of living in New York. Millions of people piled on top of one another makes the loneliness that much more unbearable. There's no telling whether, after days padding around my apartment alone, the sound of my neighbor's creaking footsteps above me brings a smile to my face or brings me to tears. I find myself standing in the middle of my room, looking straight up at my ceiling, a turkey in the rain. And yet, as fraught as being alone at home can be, there's no moment more cherished in New York than finding yourself alone in public. It always feels stolen. Being the only person in a subway car at 3 a.m., for instance, makes me want to try and get away with something. Discovering a little hidden corner of a community garden is a nearly unbearable thrill. Hoisting yourself over the wall of the neighboring building's rooftop and sprawling out on the sticky black surface where no one would think to look for you brings back memories of sneaking into other people's treehouses. When I need a moment like this, I go to Governor's Island. It's one of those places that still feels like a secret to me, even though its popularity has grown exponentially every year since I discovered it for myself. The ferry ride, albeit brief, still manages to play a psychological trick on me to make me believe I'm voyaging far away from the city, even if it's barely a quarter as long as the ferry to Staten Island. I have a bag slung over my shoulder packed with a blanket, a picnic, a book, a sketchbook, and the notebook, and my entire plan for the day is to lie in the grass and the sun. Then I will see Gail Cohen. I have just recently stumbled upon the idea of mornings. Now that I've been painting again, I found it's kind of nice to work with that thing called light you always hear artists going on about, and I feel positively stable being en route to a plan of my own making before noon. When I arrive, I mindlessly start wandering toward the far side of the island. People come here for the exercise, but people are also lazy, and they tend to quickly taper off, congealing in the nearest parks and most convenient food truck courts. Over there is where you can still get a little lost. They've recently put up hammocks in a grove of berry bushes, and when you lie in them, you can almost tune out the constant helicopter traffic overhead and pretend you're visiting your country estate. I never quite remember how to get there, but somehow my feet always take me there anyway. I'm weaving my way along the paths between the old abandoned houses when I realize someone's trying to get my attention. I do the practiced furtive glance to try and assess the situation without them realizing I've indeed noticed them. It's a woman, so my guard drops, and I look her in the eyes.
I'm sorry. Would you mind taking my picture?
She looks a bit like a time traveler from only a few years ago, wearing a big floppy hat and clutching a digital point-and-shoot camera. She gestures toward the building we're in front of.
Here, in front of the chapel.
Oh, sure. I take the camera from her hands and she removes her hat, nervously pats down her hair, blindly runs her finger around her mouth to remove any potential errant lipstick.
I just couldn't believe it. This chapel, it's named for patron saint of where I come from, Saint Cornelius.
I nod with a curt but polite smile.
Do you know him?
St. Cornelius?
Yes.
No, I do not.
Can I tell you about him?
I try not to let her see my shoulders sink or the flash of panic in my eyes. Sure. The woman brings her hand up to her chest and gazes reverently up at the chapel.
He was a man of great forgiveness and great bravery. It was a time of much persecution, and becoming pope often meant a swift death. We had gone without for months before Cornelius claimed the title. Many Christians had renounced their faith out of fear, and, among great controversy, Cornelius welcomed them back to the church. Those who sought absolution found it. And here I am on this small island, so far from home, and I find his chapel. It's unbelievable, really. Here, it's this button.
She hands me the camera and walks over to the door of the chapel, turning to pose.
Make sure you have the sign in the picture.
I nod, frame the shot, and take a few photos. As she walks back to me, I reach out to her with the camera.
Thank you. Thank you. One day, you'll come to my town, yes? My home, it's very nice there. I think you'd like it.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to visit.
Good. It's good a sign in this chapel. I think it will bring you luck, too.
I hope so. I could use some. Well, have a good one. The woman reaches out and grabs one of my hands with both of hers and looks deep in my eyes, smiling.
Thank you.
She slowly walks away, thankfully in the opposite direction of where I'm going, and I continue towards the hammocks. I find them, blissfully free, and settle into one set back a little from the path. I close my eyes and let the sun warm my face and replay my talk with the woman. I could have done without the lesson, but it's moments like these that I really cherish about living in New York. The so-called friendly regions of the country can save their hollow politesse. I'd rather have these genuine, unexpected little moments of human connection over obsessively greeting every passerby any day. Yes, those little moments of humanity can include things like a man leaning down on the train to tell me he wants to know what my pussy smells like, or a schizophrenic grabbing me by the shoulder to warn me that a demon's been following me, but they also can be like when I fainted on a sweltering day and a woman rushed to my side, brought me over to a bench, and gave me water and a granola bar, sitting with me until I felt strong enough to stand. I never knew her name. I've asked for directions on the subway, accidentally dozed off, and found myself being gently shaken awake by the person who'd guided me right as we were pulling into my stop. I know everything about the greengrocer's cat after I got Bastet's food there one time, and every time I came in to buy tomatoes and apples, she'd ask after her and give me unsolicited updates on how her cat Snowball is doing. But I couldn't tell you the person's name. I once had a 20-minute conversation about a statue that was erected in Madison Square Park that neither I nor the man I happened to be standing next to at the time could fully understand. Sure, I don't opine about the weather with the cashier when there's a line of 8 people behind me, but who fucking cares? I spend a couple of hours on the island, enjoying the relative peace and quiet. Sometimes you need to smell grass. And perhaps I need to feel a bit more at ease, a bit more like some earthy babe in the woods, because guilt was starting to creep into my stomach over stalking Gail Cohen. She was 79 years old, lived alone in a second-floor apartment in Brighton Beach. I found her birthday and address online, but there wasn't much else available to gather any idea of her. So, a couple times over a few weeks, I went down to sit on a bench across the street from her building, and I waited for her to come outside. And when she did, I trailed her a half a block behind her, steadily making her way down the street with her walker. I learned some of her habits. She played cards with some other blue-haired biddies on folding chairs on the sidewalk on Thursday afternoons. She went to the grocery store on Mondays. She liked to go on a pre-dinner stroll on the boardwalk when the sun was low and the beach was a little cooler. I figured these walks were my best bet. Despite her best efforts to keep active, she stopped for breaks frequently. She picks an empty bench to sit. I happen to need a rest myself, take the other spot. We get to talking. But, God, what was I doing? This poor, old, lonely woman. She'd probably be so grateful to have someone to talk to, even just for a few minutes. And I was just using her, trying to surreptitiously pump her for information for a mystery no one asked me to solve. Every time I found myself on that bench waiting for her door to open, I think maybe it's time to throw in the towel. There must be better ways to spend my time. I could get a job, a real job, crawl on my knees back to the ad agency and beg to be a receptionist again. At some point, though, I decided I didn't want to waste the prep work. I had already come this far to meeting Gail Cohen. I might as well complete the mission. I gathered my things and headed back to the ferry. Back in Manhattan, I was feeling my way to Rector Street. I never quite felt sure of myself down here and was just about to make an about face when a woman appeared in front of me and motioned for me to stop. "Excuse me, are you Jewish?" I never quite knew how to answer the Hasids when they asked. With only the wrong side of the family being Jewish and not willingly stepping foot in temple other than for funerals since the bat mitzvah I was practically bribed to participate in, I always wanted to say, "Not Jewish enough for you." But I had very strong opinions on who made the best locks in town and which side of the grater to use when making latkes. And I had perfected the art of sarcasm and winning arguments, so, I don't know, I still feel pretty Jewish. It was never as simple a question as people intended it to be. You have to figure out what they really mean. Maybe they're asking you your ethnicity, and you have to stop to wonder how you feel about Jewish being considered an ethnicity makes you feel that day. Is it a thing, or is it a bit Hitlerian? Maybe they're asking you if you're a practicing Jew, as in your religion, and you don't know how much of a spiel to give them about which parts exactly you practice and which you don't. Is the answer yes if I honor all of the meal traditions, but I'm not sure if I believe in God today? Maybe they're asking if you're culturally Jewish, which can have wildly different connotations based on who's asking. Maybe they're really just asking you what you think about Israel, and if that's what they mean by that, then they probably have the wrong opinion about Israel, and you're probably not wanting to get into a conversation with them anyway. It's the only part of my identity that I haven't quite figured out the right answer to, where I answer it on a whim every time. Sometimes I try responding with, "Well, what do you mean by that?" And it reminds me of when a guy asked me if I smoked, and I said, "Smoke what?" And he said, "Everyone who answers that way smokes pot but not cigarettes." Today, I look at the woman before me, think briefly of the woman at the church, and answer yes.
"Do you have everything you need for Shabbat tomorrow?"
"Oh, I don't really do anything for Shabbat."
"You don't light the candles?"
I smile and shrug at her sheepishly.
"Here, I have candles for you. Do you know the prayer?"
"I think I remember it."
"These have the prayer printed on the box. Here."
She presses a small box of 2 tea candles into my hand and looks into my eyes, and she squeezes my hand.
"It's a beautiful gift we've been given, to bring light into the world. You don't want to waste it."
I take the candles and slip them into my purse.
"Thank you."
She says what sounds like a blessing quickly, gives me a small smile, and hurries off. I continue to the train, wondering if maybe I'm being sent a sign in these holy women to stop being such a creep. But still, I make my way down to the subway and carry on toward Brighton Beach. I no longer need to pull out a map to get to Gail Cohen's building from the station. I find my bench, take a seat, and bring my book out to read as I wait for her to emerge. I'm a little earlier than planned, but I cast my eyes upward every few minutes to nonetheless make sure I'm not missing her. It's only until I've read a few chapters that I realize I've been waiting a long while. I check the time. I've come to know Gail Cohen as a punctual, habitual woman, and it's not like her to head out on her walks this late. Perhaps she's gotten caught up in a phone call, or is sick. I stretch, calculating how much longer I'm willing to wait before I give up. Maybe 20 minutes. I've come this far, after all. A half hour passes and no sign of Gail Cohen. Growing impatient, I make what may be a rash decision. I walk up to the door of her building and test it. The front door is unlocked, but it only leads to a little entryway with the mailboxes and another door to actually get inside that is locked. I stand in the room and keep an eye out. It takes 12 minutes for someone to walk up the path, and I start fumbling in my purse. It's an old man, and he creaks his way through the front door. He barely looks at me as he goes over to the mailboxes and slowly, ever so slowly, unlocks his mailbox, removes his mail, and shuts it. I continue my fumbling, and when he comes over to the door, I look up at him with an apologetic glance. He barely casts a sideways look my way as he unlocks the door, and I slip in behind him. He shuffles down the ground floor hall, and I climb up the stairs toward Gail Cohen's apartment. To my surprise, as I approach, I see her door slightly ajar. I step back, assuming she is about to come out and not being quite sure what I was supposed to do next. But I wait a few moments and nothing happens. I can hear someone moving around in her place. Am I about to interrupt a robbery? I look around for backup, but the hall is empty. I creep closer to her door, my heart starting to thud. I try peering through the crack but can hardly see anything. Before I can stop myself, I softly press my hand against the door and push. A man in his 30s is kneeling on the far side of the room and pawing through a storage container. "What are you doing?" The man whirls around. "What are you doing? This is Gail's apartment." I realize, of course, that this man could very well not be a robber. He could very well know Gail far better than me, but I figured the open door would be enough to pull off a concerned neighbor who just happens to be passing by.
"Oh, are you family?"
"What?"
"I didn't think I was expecting anyone."
He stands up and walks over to me, holding out his hand.
"I'm Jeff. I'm helping with the estate."
I take his hand and shake it, looking past him around the room. It's in disarray, boxes everywhere. It looks a lot, in fact, like my apartment. "The estate?"
"Well, it sounds a lot nicer than helping to toss all her stuff out, I guess. Ha!"
He glances at my stern face and immediately looks ashamed at his attempt to lighten the mood.
"Which I guess is why I'm so surprised to see you here. Usually if I'm here, that means there's not going to be family coming around."
I take a step forward and start slowly walking around the room. Jeff moves closer to the wall and trails me with his eyes. "She's dead. Gail Cohen is dead. A couple of weeks ago, I was following this woman down the boardwalk, watching her play cards. And now she's dead." I turn back to the man. "Jeff, you said?"
"Yes."
"I'm Anna."
"Was she your grandmother?"
"She was my great aunt. It took a bit for word to travel. We weren't all that close, but I don't know, it just felt right to come and pay my respects."
"Well, I'm sorry for your loss."
"Thank you. Do you mind? Would it be okay if I took a look around? You can keep working. I'm sure you have a lot to do. I can just start in the other rooms."
"Yeah, that's all right by me."
"Thanks." I started in her room. I immediately recognized the feeling as how I felt when I first went in a boy's room when I was 13. I'm not supposed to be here. I can see him with his hands shoved in his pockets, shoulders pressed up to his ears, looking around his room and trying to see it as I was seeing it. You never quite know someone until you see the room. That unease sticks with me to this day. My nerves kick in right before I'm about to open my bedroom door when I bring someone home. They only fade away when they're seeing me naked. I try to maneuver the plans to go to their places as often as possible. Gail Cohen's room is painted a pale green. There are four rows of perfume bottles on her dresser. There's a framed oil painting of a rolling countryside hanging above her bed, which has a comforter pushed down to the foot of it, exposing the rose pink sheets. It makes me wonder how she died. I have been hoping it was peacefully at home, but this seems to suggest otherwise. There's an armoire with the door slightly open. When I pull it open further, I see a row of dresses hanging from the bar. I recognize a few of them. Gail Cohn loves a floral print. There's a straw basket of silk scarves on the floor of the armoire, and a few old-fashioned hat boxes on the shelf at the top. I run my fingers along the dresses. I sink my hand into the scarves. I go over to the dresser. I open the top drawer. It's full of her underthings. I blush as I push it shut. I get down on my hands and knees and look under the bed. A tidy row of sensible shoes traces a path around the frame. I stand up and go over to the closet to open it, and I inhale deeply. I was close enough to smell her once on the boardwalk. It seems our ghosts hide in closets until they're released. I go back to the armoire and pocket a scarf before heading over to the other room. It's a room that's been used for a mishmash of purposes. Bookshelves line one wall. A small cluttered desk with an old PC is pushed into a corner. An armchair and a daybed compete for space along another wall. The chair is pushed practically inside the fireplace, which I hope is no longer functional, but I can so easily imagine Gail Cohn reading in the chair with the flames licking at her shins. I walk along the shelves. They're crammed with what could be the entire syllabus for Gender Studies 101. Betty Friedan, Simone de Beauvoir, Adrienne Rich, Judith Butler. There are Susan Sontag, Audre Lorde, Rachel Carson. I smile at a shelf with Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, Lindy West, Roxane Gay. I liked imagining her granddaughter setting her up with a Twitter account just so she could yell at male public figures. Gail Cohn also has the entire collection of Sue Grafton's Alphabet series. On the mantle is a display of framed photos. There's one of her and the group of women I think I recognize from the card games, then a couple of Gail Cohn throughout her life. Gail Cohn as a little girl. Gail Cohn what I guess to be her prom dress. Gail Cohn posing in a bathing suit on the beach. Gail Cohn beaming in front of the Eiffel Tower in black and white. Gail Cohn accepting an award in her 40s. It was a monument to herself. Then, at the end, was a photo of her with her arm around a man. Hoping for a glimpse into her romantic life, I pick it up to look closer. It was taken maybe 20 years ago, but it was unmistakable. Gail Cohn with her arm around Ira Baum. I grip the frame until my knuckles turn white. He had said his mother had left him, changed her name, and joined the women's movement. I look back to the bookshelves. One bottom shelf was filled with photo albums. I crouch down and pull out one from the middle. I open to the front page, and there they are, Gail and Roger Baum, holding baby Ira with a girl of 3 or 4 standing in front. I flip the pages. Gail and Ira at the beach. Gail wearing her swimming cap with plastic flowers. Roger grilling hot dogs while Gail pours the kids some lemonade. The family seated around a table with an impressive spread of cold cuts and rolls. Lydia's 6th birthday party. Lydia. Lydia Goldman is on the list. I pull another album off the shelf. This is from maybe 10 years later. Gail is on her own. There are pictures of her all around the world. There are pictures of protests. There are pictures of her consciousness-raising group. There are pictures of lovers that appear on one page and are replaced by another but a few pages later. I pull out the oldest-looking album. This one's full of black-and-white photos. A stern little girl poses with a teddy bear. I carefully slip it out of its 4 corners and turn it over. In faded pencil, the caption reads, Gail, age 7. I turn to another page and slip out a photo of a preteen Gail with an older man in a garden. Sam and Gail, 1949. I assume Sam is her father. A couple pages later, there's a formal portrait of Sam and his wife. Samuel and Deborah Needleman, 1947. Samuel Needleman, the man whose journal pages were now in the New York Historical Society's blog, who was thought to arrive from Hungary in 1938. Sure enough, several pages later, the photos get smaller and frailer. I flip one over. Sam and Debbie, Budapest, 1933. But wait, if Sam was Gail's father, then why wasn't she Gail Needleman after returning to her maiden name? Did she remarry a Cohen later in life? I haven't seen evidence of a second husband yet, but there are more albums to go through. I turn the page. Here's Sam with another woman. Sam and May, 1935. Another photo has Sam and an older man standing over May and an older woman, sitting primly on wooden chairs. The caption reads, "The Needlemans." A few pages later, May is seated holding a baby with a man in a suit standing by their side. Stuart, May, and Gail Cohen, 1937. There are three more pages of baby Gail with her parents, Stuart and May, and her uncle Sam and Aunt Debbie in Budapest. I turn back to the beginning of the album and flip through the first half of the book again. I find the next oldest album and watch Gail as a kid growing into a teenager in New York. There are no photos of Stuart and May Cohen in America.
You doing okay in here?
I jump and slam the album cover shut. Jeff takes in the scene. Me sitting on the floor surrounded by photo albums, the framed photo of Gail and Ira by my foot.
I don't mean to intrude or anything, I just know this can be tough.
Yeah, I'm fine.
Are you finding anything you'd like? Family obviously gets the priority over the estate sale or the trash.
I don't know. I haven't been looking at things like that.
Well, the process usually takes a couple of days, and I'm just getting started. If you want to come back sometime, you're welcome to.
Jeff considers me for a moment and then turns to head back to the living room, but after a step spins back around and comes back to standing in the doorway.
Maybe I should give you my number, in case you think of something you'd like. You can let me know, and if I see it, I'll put it aside for you.
Yeah, that would be nice. He takes his wallet out from his back pocket, opens it, and pulls out a business card. A familiar pang of guilt creeps through me as he walks over to me and crouches down by my side. I take the card and look into his eyes, full of concern. He hesitates, then reaches out and gently rests his hand on my upper back.
I'm sorry for your loss.
I smile. He said this already in the living room. We never know what to say. Thank you.
I'm also sorry if I've been a bit gruff. I'm so used to this kind of thing being just a job, just stuff to be dealt with. I guess I kind of forget sometimes that this stuff belonged to a real person, a person with a life and a family and people who love them.
He looks so earnest, so very earnest. Catching myself off guard, my face crinkles and a couple tears roll down my cheeks. I put my hands over my face, looking away. Jeff jerks his hand back from my shoulders.
I'll leave you alone.
Jeff leaves the room and I am left alone, surrounded by a dead woman's things. A dead woman who had a life and a family and people who loved her. A dead woman I'd never met, never known. I don't belong here. What the fuck am I doing here? I frantically stuff the albums back onto the shelf, gather my bag, and rush out of the room. Jeff rises as he hears my footsteps thundering down the hall and reflexively reaches an arm out.
Are you...
Leaving, yes. Goodbye. I'm what? A liar? I'm an intruder? I'm a fucking freak? Before I can decide on an answer, I'm out the door and running down the stairs. I burst out of the building and onto the sidewalk. What the fuck am I doing? What the fuck am I doing? I'm such a fucking piece of shit sometimes I can barely stand it. I'm a fucking piece of shit who's completely fucking lost it. What was I thinking? One small fuck up and Jeff would have had every right to call the police. I could be in a holding pen in Coney Island right now. I'm sure Rachel saw right through me. The only reason she never let on was because she pitied me. I'm sure Sarah's sitting in her studio as we speak with her tea, thinking over our conversation and picking apart the plot holes. I am an embarrassment. I'm a creep. I've done nothing but trick and manipulate and deceive these poor people, and for what? Why? What the fuck am I doing? I take a breath. I'm standing on the boardwalk, looking out on the ocean. The ocean always takes me by surprise. It's easy to forget that I live on an island. When the buildings are towering over you, closing in on you, when you're stacked in boxes upon boxes upon boxes, it's bizarre to remember that this vast openness is just a few miles away. I look around me, remembering I am of my body. I'm not just a buzzing blur of thoughts racing through the air. I am a person in this world. I notice my hands again. I am clutching Jeff's business card in my left hand so tightly I can feel the corners of it cutting into my skin. I release my grip and look down at the crumpled card in my palm. I see Jeff's sympathetic face in my mind. I didn't deserve that sympathy. He didn't deserve to cross paths with me. I take out my phone and text the number on the card. I'm sorry, as I guess what I was about to say. I'm sorry I thought you were a burglar and yelled at you. That was more messed up of me than you probably even know. I'm sorry I distracted you and messed up your work. I'm sorry I rushed out all of a sudden without thanking you for your help. But thank you for all your help. I put the phone and the card in my bag and walk across the boardwalk, down the nearest steps, and out into the sand. The beach isn't too crowded at this point in the day. I walk closer to the water and sit down. I think of Ira, wondering where he is, wondering if he knows his mother is dead, wondering when was the last time he talked to her. His face looks so strained in the photo of him on the mantel. He clearly never forgave her, but I still couldn't believe a son would hear his mother had died and choose not to tend to her after her death, to leave her to be dealt with by some contractor. He didn't want those photo albums. He didn't want to say goodbye to his mother in any way. No. Clearly he must not have ever known. Although the thought of a mother and son living in the same city and never speaking, so far removed that one never even knew of the other's death, wasn't that much better to bear. Gail Cohen and her estate had been left to be dealt with like those mythical women who die in their apartments and are eaten by their cats because no one's left who loves them enough to care to check on them when her son was but a subway ride away. I shouldn't pity Gail Cohen, though. She seemed happy. She seemed free. What a terrible thought to live life on your own terms and yet still be reduced to who loves you and who doesn't once you're dead. I listen to the waves for a while. I try to match my breathing to them. The rhythm of it, the crashing, the receding, the crashing, the receding. The crashing, the receding, lulls me. It reminds me of the rhythm of the mourner's Kaddish, the voices of the congregation swelling in unison, chanting through the dirge, pounding and pounding at the words before fading away, then rising up again. It sounds like a trudging march through the mud, the sound of the Jewish people, defiantly forward in the face of loss. And then, the prayer stops. The silence is a buzz, and you begin to hear the whispers of names, the names of the dead. 3 times I stood there, heat rising in my cheeks, wet with tears. They all knew and were waiting for me. I'd wait until the trickle of names slowed and then meekly say my names. Rebecca, Jonathan, Hannah. I close my eyes and the waves speak the prayer.
Yitgadal v'yitgadash shemei rabba. Bama devrach hute v'yamlich mahute v'hayahon u'vayahon u'vaye d'cho beit Israel v'agala v'zman kariv v'mru. Amen. Yehe shemei rabba mevarach la'olam u'lamei almaya. Yit barach, v'yit shtabach, v'yit ba'ar, v'yit roman, v'yit nesev, v'yit hadar, v'yit alev, v'yit halal, shemei dekudisha, brichu. Leila minkol barhata v'sharata tishbahata, v'nechamata damriman balma v'imru, amen. Yehe shlema rabba min shemaya, v'hayim aleinu v'alkol Yisrael, v'imru, amen. O se shalom b'mermav. Hu ya'ase shalom, aleinu v'al kol Yisrael, v'imru, amen.
This has been Chapter 5 of This Used to Be the Place. Gail Cohen, 1937, Brighton Beach. It was written, read, and produced by me, Celeste Kaufman. Additional voice work was provided by Adriana Rosetto and Clifton Butt. Music is courtesy of Eva Schlegel. Next up is Chapter 6, Alana, 1986. Thanks for listening.